It's Thursday morning, just after 11 a.m, and it is my great pleasure to say once again, good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zan. I'm so jealous that you've had another one of your amazing US trips.
You had one as well.
Yeah, well, actually on the weekend.
Not too long ago.
No, no. In fact, on the weekend I was in Hong Kong. The Chinese government got me over there to talk to a whole bunch of school teachers.
Oh, wow.
So that was the second part of my civil disobedience or disruption tour, which began in Thailand earlier this year.
Yeah.
And then that was the second part in Hong Kong.
You go where the danger is.
Yeah, so I've booked us flights to Syria next weekend. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Well, it's very good to see you again. A couple of weeks away, of course, you were here last week with Gemma Pike doing science. I was just showing you something called an integratron, which I went into this time last week, on Thursday last week, in the desert of California, just near Palm Springs and Joshua Tree. And it was made by a guy who, let's just say, he had a vision. He was visited by a quote-unquote prophet, made this perfectly round building that he said was going to do all kinds of crazy stuff. Then he passed away, but now it's been turned into this space where people have sound baths. And I lay in there last week with my head towards the center while someone played these quartz bowls, mm-hmm, kind of like this tonal gongy sort of sound, and had the most incredible meditation ever. And I know that everyone is screaming hippie at the radio right now.
Nothing wrong with that.
But is there anything scientific behind this, or is it just feeling good and this, I guess, the drone of that sound being so intense because it's right next to me and traveling through that perfectly cylindrical wooden space, just making me feel good?
Both. Firstly, the object is like a sphere, like you get an orange or a tennis ball and cut in half.
Yeah.
And so you're underneath this half sphere. And if you ever see a half sphere in a hotel, in a building, make a little clicking noise or slap your hands together and then walk towards the center, then you'll hear a sudden change in sound. And so they had your head towards the center?
Yeah, everyone had their heads towards the center.
Okay, firstly, it's long been known that certain repetitive sounds can bring on hallucinations, full-blown hallucinations a la LSD, psilocybin, magic mushrooms. Normally, you do it via a religious experience where you do the droning or you do the dancing or the slapping or the rocking backwards and forwards. But if you do it for long enough, you will go down that pathway and have full-on hallucinations, but you're looking at 12 hours. Here, you're getting down there fairly quickly without having to work hard, and so you're just lying there in the sound comes towards you.
Felt good.
Yeah, and you are getting into a genuine hallucinogenic experience. There's an article about hallucinations in the Scientific American about 2 years ago, and it deals with how sounds can do that. So they took you part of the way down there. And sure, there's that hippie dippy. Do they promise to align your kundalinis, your chakras? Is your handwriting better?
It was just a good meditation and a lovely way to spend an afternoon. I recommend you checking it out, actually. Just type in Integratron into Wikipedia. The Arctic Monkeys actually recorded part of their song Secret Door there in 2008. A lot of other people have used it. You might have seen it on an episode of Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations. Very cool place. And yes, in the middle of the desert, full of magical, mystical things.
I'd love to go
things
there. In fact, Death Valley, which is not far from there, apparently is one of the hottest places on Earth. There's a few disputes about the records, but it's one of the hottest. And just recently, they've solved the mystery of the stones that skid by themselves across the floor of the Death Valley Desert.
How?
What happens is that you have hot, you have cold, you're inland, and the temperature goes sub-zero. A layer of ice is formed. It then shrinks down to a thin layer of ice, and ice has incredibly low friction, so you've got ice on ice. And then the merest wind will blow these boulders, 5-10 kilograms, across on this track. And then they're sort of scudding, poking through the ice, leaving behind a little tiny bit of friction track behind them. Then the ice melts, and there you've got this stone that has moved by itself some 20 meters. The scientists finally managed to get some cameras out there running full time, and after 3 years, 3 years of recording every day and every night, finally they had exactly the right conditions and they could see the ice form, and then the wind came up because they had wind measuring devices, and then they started scudding across the ice.
The desert is an amazing place. 1-300-055-36 is the number to call. Dr. Carl is with you for the next 45 minutes or so and talking science. And if you want to get through to him with any answers or comments, you can hit him up direct at Dr. Carl on Twitter or text us 0439 757 555. Talking about heat and changes of weather, we're going to start with our first caller in Dubbo this morning. Hey, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, good. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
It just seems today, like, this has happened pretty much every year for a fair while, that when it gets hot and I turn the aircon in the work vehicles of my ute for the first time in the season, I seem to get the flu, and I had that happened last Friday, and I'm sick as a dog now. So I'm just wondering if there's anything to it.
When you say the flu, do you have a fever and sore muscles and joints?
Or yeah. It starts off in the back of my throat, and then, I feel like I've got something in my throat, and then it just, moves on to the flu, and I get, it's not severe, but I get, mild shivers and that at night, but,
Okay, so you're having something more serious than the common cold, and this is associated with changes of season. It could well be that buried in the aircon various naughty pathogens like a whole lot of pollen and stuff and bacteria and fungi that have had a chance to go, and that when you turn on the aircon, they come all blowing out there and they give an insult to your immune system. On the other hand, it could be just simply that you think it happened last year, so it'll happen again. Now, you say you've only got 2 years of this happening, this year and last year?
Nah, years and years. It's reoccurring. That's why I called up, because I actually know now, I sort of say that I'm going to get sick when I get the aircon, so it might be my brain, but I'm pretty cooked.
Now, here's the killer question. Did you write it down?
No, I didn't write it down.
That close to a Triple J fun pack, man.
I mean, I did write it down, yeah. I just don't have it around.
You changed your answer very quickly there, Tom.
Yeah, I forgot. I can fabricate something for you if you'd like it.
I think his dog ate his homework.
Yeah, look,
pretty much.
It could be confirmation bias, and it could be the stuff. By the way, last thing about the aircon, use the aircon at least once every week, because you have what are called O-rings in there. And they're rubber rings made, they look like the letter O. And if you let the aircon system just sit, they flatten out and they can leak the refrigeration gases in the environment. So just use it once every week to keep them flexible, just for a few minutes, then off again.
Good
and that
tips.
Way you don't get all of the pathogens coming out in one big hit either.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Good
Thank
luck.
You.
Hope you feel better soon. We're going to head to the Yarra Rangers now. Ryan's on the phone. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Great. What's your question?
I was just wondering, does the moon affect blocked noses and ears? Because there's been a huge moon lately. I saw the 70% water might affect.
What the moon and the sun do is they pull the water in the tides around. However, they'll pull any liquid. If it was mercury, if it was liquid molten iron or molten gold, they'd still pull it. There is zero proof that the moon has any effects on us. You talk on one hand to the people who work in emergency and they'll say, oh, yes, we always get a big burst of people on the full moon. Confirmation bias, it's a busy night, you look out the window, whole bunch of people, big moon, and you think, okay, it causes it. If you do the big studies where you look at not just one night but several hundred thousand people being admitted over a 10-year window to 10 teaching hospitals in country after country, you do not see this happening.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Sorry.
Thanks for the call, Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan.
Also, a couple of texts coming through. Someone saying regarding getting the cold or the flu after you switch the aircon on for the first time, tell him to check his tonsils. I get that with hotel air conditioning. And someone else says it's BAS, bad air conditioning system. Every aircon, it says from every aircon guy out there, this guy's a nutter. So I'm not sure whether or not it is a confirmation bias or not. But, air conditioning does seem to stir up a lot of cold and flu reactions in people.
Yeah. What happens is you can have a drying out of the airways, and then this makes them more liable to have infectious agents come in.
Let's go now to Kai in Canberra. Hey, Kai.
Hey, how you going, Doctor?
Hi, Kai.
Good. What's your question?
I was just wondering why we itch. And why does scratching satisfy that?
We've only discovered the nerves that carry itch in the last 15 years or so, as in fact we discovered the nerves that carry pain. And I'm going to tell you a fundamental truth. Itch and pain are two ends of a seesaw. One goes up, one goes down. Let me give you the fairly inaccurate cliche view of a junkie. The junkie has injected themselves with a painkiller. They're not feeling any pain. They're scratching themselves. Itch, itch, yeah, scratch, scratch, scratch. So if pain goes down, itch goes up and vice versa. I was reading a story about a woman who had an itch on her scalp and kept on scratching so much, it went right through her, with her fingernails, she went through her scalp and through her skull. She actually scratched through the bone of her skull. The thing that was causing the itch was long gone, but the pattern had been set up. So why does scratching relieve an itch? You're causing some pain, and that's the other end of the seesaw. That's one way of looking at it. The other one is the so-called gate theory, which is a kind of soft theory in medicine that you've got two impulses that are trying to head towards your brain, and in this case it's either pain or an itch. you give the pain. It's the only one that can get through the gate so the itch doesn't get through.
Hey, there you go. Thanks for the call, Kai.
Thank you.
This makes sense. Whenever I get a mosquito bite, instead of itching, just makes me want to itch more, I usually just get my fingernail and sort of make a cross in it. So I make give it pain, and that seems to kill the itch.
Yes.
The same sort of theory going on there.
That works. But also there's the confirmation bias once again where my mother taught me to put some spit on it, and that fixes it because my mother told me it would.
A lot of people on the text line saying that they do the same thing with their mozzie bites. They do the cross. And some people also saying that they too spit on their mozzie bites. So whatever works. We also have that answer whenever we talk
whatever
science.
Works.
Whatever makes you feel good, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. Aaron is calling in from Wollongong this morning. Thanks so much for staying on the line, Aaron. What's your question?
Dr. Carl, Dr. Zinn, how are you?
Hello, good.
Okay, I've got a bit of a random question. I go to a fair few car burnout competitions.
Mm-hmm.
Just wondering what the, if there is, health side effects to this.
Basically, whenever you burn anything, you create a huge range of what are called combustion products. Some of them are irritating, some of them don't have any effect on your health, some of them do. Overwhelmingly, burning anything creates such a wide range of combustion products that some of them will be bad from you, for you. In the old days, you used to be able to burn off stuff in your backyard. And so you just put together all the leaves, a bit of rubbish, a bit of bits of wood, and you'd burn it off. If you had complete combustion, all you'd end up with would be carbon dioxide, water, and a few oxides of nitrogen. But you don't get complete combustion. And so you'd have more dioxins coming out of your backyard fire than a professional incinerator would give. So with regard to the burnouts, they're lots of fun. And on the other hand, there will be some minor health risk. But I think they're fairly minor.
Hey, thanks for the call, Aaron.
No worries.
Thank you.
Let's head now to Manly. Rowena's on the line. Hey, Rowena.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Great,
Rowena,
thanks.
Welcome.
What's your question?
Thanks. I just wanted to know, I suppose everybody has a car alarm, but when you get a further distance away and you can't push the button, I've been told if I put it up against my temple, it'll work, and I do it, and then my car alarm works. And I was just wondering why that is.
So this is the remote control blipper so that you can open the car doors from a distance.
Yeah.
So what's happening is that you're doing a phenomenon called coupling or inductive coupling, where by putting the metal against your body, it is acting as an antenna. I'm just suddenly thinking, does the metal have to physically touch your flesh or will it still work without? So maybe you can do the experiment of getting some thick paper and press on the paper and then so you've only got about a tenth of a millimetre and I think it would still work. It might be you don't need to have the physical contact but it couples and your body acts as an antenna.
Yeah, right, okay.
But the real lesson is you got to get the battery replaced.
Thanks for the call, Rowena.
Thanks. Okay,
thank you, Rowena.
Josh is calling in from Fitzroy this morning. Hey, Josh.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I hit my fingernail with a hammer the other week.
Ouch.
And I had to get, no good at all. I had to get plastic surgery and get my nail removed. And I was just wondering, where does the nail grow back from and how long?
There's an anatomical region called the nail bed in which blood comes in and out is extruded. This amazing keratin structure called the fingernail.
Mm.
So go to Wikipedia and look up nail bed and just remember it's fed with blood. So different things in your body make different organs. So basically the female breast is a modified sweat gland that turns blood into milk and your nail bed turns blood into keratin.
There you go.
Ain't it wonderful?
How good's that?
Good luck.
It's
good
amazing.
Luck with the recovery, Josh.
No, cheers.
Thanks for that. Be careful with that hammer as well. That sounds
very
painful.
Yeah, you've got to watch out. You've got to watch out for them.
Clearly. Thanks for the call, Josh.
Cheers.
We're going to head now to Jindalup. Callum is on the phone. Hey, Callum.
Hey, Zan.
You're 14 years old. The school holiday is still going in WA or are you taking the day off?
School holidays finish on Monday, Thursday.
Sweet as. Well, I'm very glad that you're able to give us a call. Usually in class. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
My question is, why does density cause gravitational force?
It's not necessarily density, it's mass. Let me tell you the incredibly clever words of John Wheeler from the University of Texas at Austin, your favourite place, Dr. Zan.
Stop it.
Austin is like Boston in Texas. And here is clever words in two parts with a comma in between. Mass curves space, comma, and curved space tells mass where to go.
Okay.
So imagine you've got the sun and then suddenly, hey, here's the Earth. The Earth has a lot of mass and it curves the space around it. Yep. And so the we're not too sure why, but we know that it does. So the mass of the Earth curves the space. So mass curves space and then curved space tells mass where to go. Well, I'm stuck to the ground. If I jump up, I fall down to the ground. If I drop my pen, if I let go of my pen, it will fall towards the ground. So the gravitational field that has been caused by that mass then causes mass to go to the center of that gravitational field. It's a very deep concept. Look up anything by John Wheeler. He's a very understandable guy. And also, Professor Geraint Lewis has written on this in the website called Conversations, I think. Read that one up as well.
Hey, thanks for the call, Callum.
Yeah, thanks. See ya.
Enjoy the last few days of holidays as well. Let's head to Hobart now. Rosie is on the phone. Hey, Rosie.
Morning, doctors.
Good morning. What's your question?
I was just wondering why I get earaches when my body gets too hot or too cold.
Earaches?
Yeah.
Ah, in both ears?
Yeah, so if I go for a run on a cold day, I get earaches, but then also, you know, on a hot day, I just, you know, I lose my hearing and...
You actually lose your hearing?
Well, it's a bit disorientating because I can't hear properly.
So you might hear somebody talking to you and their volume that you perceive is less?
Yeah, it's just muffled. So I can make out some words, but not all.
Okay, two parts. First part I can answer, second part I've got no idea. You have a nerve called the Arnold nerve, A-R-N-O-L-D-S. Look up on Wikipedia, as I always say. Also called the Alderman nerve, and that's related to the vagus nerve, which wanders through your body. And that explains in some people, because of a crossover from one nerve to the other, electrical impulses leaking across, that explains why when they scratch their ear, they cough. That's the Arnold nerve, Arnold reflex, Alderman nerve. Look up on Wikipedia. You're saying that the outside world is muffled. Okay, so what happens is that the sound comes in through your ear. It is impedance matched. It delivers a lot of its energy to the eardrum. That moves backwards and forwards. And then some tiny little bones called the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup move. And they've got little muscles on them. And those muscles can be activated if you hear, for example, a thunderbolt. The sound of a thunderclap, they will pull on those bones and stop them from moving so much. So therefore the sound is muffled because what those bones do is then push on a window and on the other side of that window is a liquid and that liquid gets pressure waves in it, in the cochlea, and those pressure waves then bend little hairs, and those hairs when they bend give off electricity. Somewhere in that process is something going on. I don't know off the top of my head.
Maybe see an ear, nose and throat doctor
Maybe,
and get that checked out.
If it's real, yeah. Almost certainly it is not pathological. It won't shorten your life expectancy or anything like that. But it'd be interesting just to get it checked out if it truly is that other people's voices are muffled.
Hey, best of luck, Rosie. Thanks for the call. Daniel's on the line from Melbourne. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, how you going, guys?
Hi, Daniel.
What's your question?
It's a bit of a hard one to explain, but if you have two floodlights in a room, both pointing in the same direction, both the same bulb, same power output, would the luminous intensity double at the point where they're focusing on, or would it be the same as having one light?
I reckon it would double because you've got twice as many photons coming out. And so the photon, by the way, just another very fundamental truth, light is a wave when it travels, or it's a photon when it is created or destroyed. So when you measure it as being destroyed, and so you've got twice as many photons, so you've got twice the brightness.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks, heaps.
Thank you for the call, Daniel. Let's head now to Warren Dyett. Matt's on the phone. Hey, Matt.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good, Matt. Thanks. What's your question?
Mine's to do with fire. Basically, what is fire? My basic understanding of it is it's a gas coming off of the material that you're burning. So is it a gas? Why can you see it? And why does it give off light?
Going backwards, it gives off light because as a result of the chemical reaction which is usually carbon plus oxygen, gives you carbon dioxide plus heat. As a result of the heat energy, electrons are forced up to a higher energy level. Electrons orbiting around an atom, around the center of an atom, in the same way that, similar way to planets around the sun. They're forced up to a higher energy level, and as they fall down, they give off light. They give off energy, and sometimes that energy appears as visible light. You cannot burn a solid. You cannot burn a gas. You can only burn a liquid. The reason you can't burn a solid or a gas is that they're too concentrated, and you've got to have that chemical reaction where the carbon, usually carbon, can be nitrogen, mixes with the oxygen. So it's only when you've got a gas that you can have enough surface area for them all to intermingle. So the whole point is you've got to get that heat happening. So you heat up the solid until it's the liquid until it's a gas, and then the gas does the combustion. So you've got to get over that energy hump. You can think of it as a plasma if it gets up to about 5,000 degrees where the electrons are actually torn off. That depends on the heat of the flame. Normally it's not that hot.
Right.
Thanks for the call, Matt.
No problem, Dr. Matt.
See you later. Let's head to Hawthorne, hanging around in Victoria. Ryan is on the line. Hey, Ryan.
Dr. Carl, Dr. Zan, how are you
guys? Hi, Dr. Ryan. Winner of the Hawks AFL.
Oh, yeah. You a Hawks supporter?
No, unfortunately. It would have been nice to get a premiership this year.
Yeah, I was there for my
Hang on, what do you mean it would have been AFL? Nice? Who do you support?
Yeah, what do you do?
I go for Brisbane.
Oh, right, okay. So you were just surrounded by Hawks supporters in your home suburb?
Pretty much.
What's your question for Dr. Carl?
My question's about the burp reflex. Now, my girlfriend, she hasn't burped in her life, and or maybe once or twice. And even when she drinks beer, when she drinks soft drink, it doesn't happen. She gets a bit of a tummy ache or like bit of gas in the tummy, but it doesn't come up. I'm just wondering what that's about.
I don't know. I haven't done a story on it yet. I can tell you heaps about hiccups. Pretty good on farting too.
Now, does she burp out the other end, Ryan?
Not that I know of.
Have you asked her?
No, I haven't asked her that. But
maybe like all other women, she just farts glitter because women don't fart, of course, as you know, Dr. Carl.
No, what's happening is you've got gas. The gas can be either solid or generated by the food, and beans are famous for that, or incorporated into the food, if you can call carbonated drinks a food. But then there are a couple of little valves on the way. There's the lower esophageal sphincter, which is a kind of valve. I'm out of my depth on burps. I have not done a story on burps, and I need to, so I understand it properly. On one hand, you can have people who never burp. On the other hand, one of my colleagues actually is such a good burper that she provided all of the burps for the movie Les Patterson Saves the World. Now, we're going back in time a little bit here. Did she get a burp artist credit? No. Unfair.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. We'll see if anybody else can offer up some information for us. Let Ryan know. I've never heard of anyone who can't burp. I don't know whether it's nature or nurture.
Yeah, and look, I've just looked up on Wikipedia and it says the source of the sound of burping is unknown, comma, but might be due to the rapid passage of air through the lower esophageal sphincter. And then they quote a paper, wait for it, from 2014, from the American Journal of Physiology. So we're dealing with a serious journal. And even in 2014, we do not know. I'm going to have to read that for my homework next week. The loudest burp, according to the Guinness World Record, is 109 dB, which is louder than a jackhammer at 1 meter.
This sounds like a fun article to read.
Yeah.
Can you tweet that out?
We'll tweet. Here
okay. Dr. Carl's going to tweet that out. You might be able to find some answers there. Ryan, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you very much, guys.
And if you do want to follow Dr. Carl on Twitter, it is a very informative person and read to follow. At Dr. Carl is how you find him, DrCarkarl if you're on Twitter. Let's head now to Andy calling in from Mount Evelyn this morning. Hey, Andy.
G'day. How you going?
Very well, thanks. What's your question?
The missus and I have had this trivial conflict for a while. Adverse effects for leaving suds on your dishes after washing them. Is there any, or should you rinse?
For no good reason, I rinse. Now, I'm fairly obsessive when it comes to washing dishes and using the twin dishwashers in the mode that gives them the maximum efficiency in water and electricity. I do not think that there is any long-term harm from the suds, simply because of the history of using detergent-like materials to wash plates over a long period of time. There may be problems with the taste. And so I'm lucky enough to live with people who basically cook a brand new meal that they never cooked before in their whole life from a recipe book every night. Every night I'm eating something new, but it's always basic, simple food. And they have a go at me for using the same breadboard and knife for cutting up fruit as I do for garlic, and I call it fusion. They call it a heresy, and I should be burnt at the stake. And some people would pick up the taste. My family would. I don't think there's any danger.
Now, is there a difference between hand washing and the dishwasher? I'm specifically asking about hand washing.
Okay, so with hand washing, you might get some very thin detergent-like residue left if you do not rinse it off. With a dishwasher, it finishes off with a rinse cycle and then heats it up. So it's actually probably cleaner. But on the other hand, with washing by hand, you get that lovely person-to-person social interchange.
So much going on. Thanks for the call, Andy.
No, thanks for that.
Hey, we've got heaps of people texting in too on 0439 757 555 about also not being able to burp. Someone texting in saying my sister can't burp. She has to make herself gag to release the gas. Jason in Perth says my mate has the same burping problem and has to stick his fingers down his throat to release the pressure. He calls it a yerp, a yak burp. And another person saying they never burped until they're about 22. They just have a large buildup of pressure in their chest. Then one day I was yawning and a burp came out. Since then, it was like I somehow recognize the muscle and I can burp whenever. This is something I've never heard of before, but a lot of people are identifying it with it on the text line. So amazing.
Well, it probably has a special medical name. By the way, the minimum vocabulary you need to get by in the English language is 800 words. The average vocabulary of a medical doctor is 50,000 words. And I'm sure that this word exists. A meaning not, burp meaning to burp, osis, the state of, aburposis. I'm sure it is a genuine medical word.
Let's head now to Launceston where Zach's on the phone. Hi, Zach.
Doctors.
Dr. Zach, love your work.
Zach is ready to talk science. What's your question?
I'm just at uni right now. I'm a freediver and...
You're crazy. How deep do you go?
Well, my maximum, 17, 20 metres. So that was like my peak.
20 metres? Mate, my ears hurt at 4. You're some sort of crazy man.
You've got to equalise your ears.
Go on.
Anyway, I'd love to hold my breath for long periods of time if I could. And I was reading this article and it says that like whales and dolphins and stuff, they have like high concentrations of myoglobin in their tissue cells. I was wondering, could we put that into human beings so we could hold our breath for longer?
I was reading an article upon how whales do, or the special physiological adaptations that whales have for being able to stay underwater for about half an hour, and I've completely forgotten every single one of them. Yes, we could modify humans, but isn't the world record for free diving breath holding 4 minutes or 5 minutes or something?
Something crazy like that.
How do they do that?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. So, I'd love to be able to, though. Yeah, for an hour or something, that'd be really cool.
Then you'd be a different animal. I remember once I was having a barbecue at my place and a guy said, you have no fish. He was a foreign guy. And then he came back about an hour and a half later with a fish about the length of his arm. And I said, where do you get the fish? He said, I just swam out about a kilometre. I swam out and then swam down to the ocean floor with my spear gun about 15 metres down and I waited until a fish went past and I shot it and I swam back. Who are these crazy people?
So what do you think about myoglobin? Not possible? Possible?
Does myoglobin have more or less oxygen carrying capability? The thing about hemoglobin is that it's specialised for picking it up in one environment and then dumping it in another environment when you've got high acidity, something to do with temperature. Don't know. Almost certainly we could genetically engineer ourselves to stay longer underwater. And finally it turns out that this is just a complete thing out of left field. Mitochondria, who invaded us 2 billion years ago, they do adaptations that allow Tibetans to withstand lower oxygen at different altitudes. I was just reading this in the latest New Scientist. So read that. It's the New Scientist with a cover called Imagination.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Zach.
Thank you.
Just take care with your free diving as well. Make sure that you play it safe.
17-meter show off.
There are quite a few people texting in and saying that in terms of the world record for holding the breath, it's anywhere from 16 to 20 minutes, according to the text line. So
wow.
I can't even take a deep breath in yoga.
So what they do is there's a rope going down to the ocean floor. They then hang onto a weight and then go down as quickly as they can and then hang down there, then come back up again.
It's incredible.
Wow. Yep. And it's not like they can fake it anywhere. They're not carrying a little oxygen cylinder or anything.
Human beings are amazing. Daniel's calling in from Narrabeen this morning with his question. Hey, Daniel.
Hi, Zan. Hey, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Hello. Daniel, welcome.
My question relates to accents, language accents.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, is there a certain age at which the brain will stop learning to adapt or recognise a new accent if you move to a new country?
What do you mean? You mean learn a new language?
Well, for example, if a family of four moves to Australia like we did in 1990,
mm-hmm.
You know, I've been here 20 years and I don't have a British accent, but my parents still have full-blown English accents, and same with a lot of our family and friends.
So how old were you when you moved to Australia?
Six.
Okay,
so the traditional truth was that when you were young, you could pick up languages easily, and then when you were older, you couldn't. And that belief seems to be fading. I first came across something against this when I was walking across Spain in 2009, and I met this guy who had learned 18 languages, and it was his hobby to learn a new language every year. And the only difficulty was thinking, which language will I jump off from? So if I'm going to learn Czechoslovakian, should I go there from Chinese or from Finnish? Yeah, which I use as my intermediate language. And it seems to some degree that the reason that adults have trouble in learning languages is that they're just scared of making mistakes. And the kids don't care, and they just do it over and over and over and over again, and then they just get there. Secondly, with regard to learning languages, my father, when he was a young man, learned English so well that he was working as an interpreter in London for the Polish embassy, and he had an accent-free English accent. In other words, he spoke what he had learned, which was the upper-class English accent, and it was people did not believe, my father could speak 12 languages, they did not believe that he was Polish. They thought that he was just another Englishman who happened to work for the Polish embassy. He forgot all of that during the Second World War, went through the concentration camps, learned English again after the Second World War, and had this accent.
Wow.
So the first time he learned it was without an accent. Second time, he could not get rid of the accent.
When you're a little kid, though, if you move to a country as a child, you're more likely to lose your accent than if you're an adult that's been speaking in that accent for 20, 30 years.
Yeah, but the thought is that because you don't care about making mistakes, or is it something different about the brain? And it's sort of up for grabs. There's still more flexibility in the younger brain, but not as much as we thought.
I reckon that people also choose whether they hold on to their accent as well.
Ah.
My brother lives in Canada and he has a rounded accent, but I know other people who've lived in North America for many years and they hold on to their Australian accent. So I think there's a personal choice in there as well.
Ah.
Anyway, there's so much to explore, but it's a good question. Thanks for the call, Daniel.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks.
We're going to head to Lismore next. We have on the phone a 10-year-old fella called Jedi. Hi, Jedi.
Hi.
Hi, Jedi.
Were your parents Star Wars fans?
My dad was.
Yeah. It's a great name. What's your question?
I was wondering if antimatter was real and what would happen if antimatter and matter came together?
Antimatter is real. We've been making and storing it for about 70 years. Firstly, what is antimatter? Did you learn about atoms yet, Jedi? How they got a central core like the sun and it's called the nucleus and it's positive and that there's sort of electrons going around it which are negative, like little planets around the sun? Did you learn that bit so far?
My mum and my dad have told me a bit about that.
Okay, so the important thing is that the center bit, the nucleus, is positive. And the things going around, the electrons are negative. Antimatter has exactly the same shape, but the charges are reversed. So the center, the core, the nucleus, the sun, instead of being positive, is negative. And the electrons, instead of being negative, are positive. They're called positrons. We've been making and storing it for over half a century. Every time you go to a hospital for a certain type of scan, I think it's a PET scan, they actually make some antimatter on the spot. What happens with antimatter when it meets regular matter is total annihilation with 100% conversion to energy. So if you're burning, for example, carbon to make heat, you're getting about a thousandth of a percent conversion. If you're doing a nuclear burning, you get maybe 1% conversion of the mass into energy. If you do antimatter, you're getting 100% conversion to energy. So Star Wars got it right in having antimatter engines.
It's all come full circle. Thanks so much for the call, Jedi. See you later. And may the force be with you.
May the force be with you. He was probably born on the 4th of May.
We've got time for one more really quick question, yeah. And we're going to get it from Neil in Wollstonecraft. Hey, Neil.
Hi, Neil.
Oh, hang on. I forgot to press the button.
The button.
I needed the force. Hey, Neil.
Hi.
Hi. Have you got a quick question for us?
Yes, I'll try. My question is, I think, related to deja vu, and it's when I boil my kettle and then I go watch TV and I forget about it, I get distracted, mm-hmm. and then a couple of minutes later, I'll think I've heard the kettle boil again, and I go, oh, yeah, I remembered, I just boiled the kettle, and I'll go off. So I'm just wondering what's that about?
So you'll remember the sound?
Yeah, it's as if it's like I hear the end of the kettle boiling, and even though I know it's impossible that it's actually happened, because I remember I did it like minutes ago when it's finished boiling already. So,
okay, is the TV in a different room from the kettle?
Yeah, I mean, in a completely different room.
Going through a doorway will make you forget what happened. This is an ancient reflex, so when you're in the jungle, you worry about the gorillas. The moment you leave the jungle, forget about the gorillas and concentrate on the killer lions in front of you. There's something, that was only discovered last year, there's something opposite to that where you're somehow invoking the physical sensation of the sound to remind you that you've got to have one of the finest drinks known to the human race, a cup of tea. And by the way, do you use leaf tea or tea bag?
Tea bag.
Oh, you were so close.
Thanks so much for the call, Neil.
Thank you, Neil.
I feel like you guys are flirting, Dr. Carl. That is where we're going to end today's Science Talk Back. Dr. Carl will be back with you at 11 a.m. next Thursday. And as I mentioned, if you missed out or you want to relive today all over again, triplej.net.au for the podcast. See you next week, Carl.